All right. Good morning, everybody. Again, my name is Andrew, and excited to be here with you as we continue and really wrap up our journey through the book of Leviticus. As we get going today, though, I actually need some help from someone who I hope trusts me. So, Colin, do you trust me? Great. Come on up here, Colin. That would be wonderful. So I've known Colin probably since he was in first grade, maybe a little longer. I don't know. It's been a long time. So, and he's always this slow. He's always this fast moving and getting up here. So, Colin, we're just going to do a simple trust fall. Okay. So I'm going to have you face that direction. And whenever I tell you, I'm going to have you fall backwards. Do not fall forward. Okay. And I want you to know I'm going to catch you. Okay. So go ahead and fall. Okay, very good. Let's maybe do that one more time. Okay, go ahead. All right, very good. Now, turn around here because the it's way too early in the service to have this be like a punchline. What I want to do is actually look at the anatomy of a trust fall. What is it that makes up a successful trust fall? Okay, so two things, or no, there's like seven things, but the first thing is two, and that's at least two people participating, right? So two of us, that's great. And at least one of them has to be trustworthy, right? Like, untrustworthy person, not going to lead to a very trust fallish success type thing. Okay, so you have trustworthy people involved in the process. Number two, you have a promise. What was the promise I made to Colin?
He'll catch me.
I'll catch you, right? And then I gave an invitation. What was the invitation? To fall. Okay, great, great. Now, in this, there's another piece, and that is that there is real risk, okay? Like, the risk, like, with Colin falling back is, well, I could just step out of the way and let him go, right? And Colin's getting to the point in his life where that means visits to chiropractor or PT. He's not quite there yet, but he's getting there, okay? Sooner than he realizes. So you have that piece going on, the real risk going on, and then you've got two more pieces I'm going to talk about right now. And that is, one, an act of trust, which is what?
Trusting you'll catch me.
Trusting you'll catch me. And then an act of trustworthiness where I do what?
Catch
you. Great. Very good. Thank you. Appreciate it. Give him a round of applause. See, heads down. The first person I went to at first service, I went to them beforehand and they said, I don't know that I trust you. So I didn't use them. And I decided this service, I'm just not going to ask and make him tell you guys he doesn't trust me. But anyways, whenever we think about a trust fall, that came to mind this week because we come to a passage in Leviticus chapter 25, and you can move or flip there now if you have your Bibles with you. But whenever we come to Leviticus chapter 25, we come to a passage that I think it's a lot like a lot of other truths that we find in Scripture that if we were really honest, we would say, I don't know that I have like trust fall level trust in God coming through on his promises. That makes sense? Like there are truths that maybe God says that maybe you would say like, oh, absolutely. I believe God is a provider and that he's trustworthy. But if it came to the point where it was like, are you willing to really risk something? We might be a little more hesitant. Today we come to one of those things in Leviticus chapter 25 as we wrap up this series, and God gives a command to the people of Israel about a rhythm of life that they are to have that seems pretty extreme. Here's what we find in Leviticus chapter 25, verses 1 and 2. It says, the Lord said to Moses at Mount Sinai, speak to the Israelites and say to them, when you enter the land I am going to give you, the land itself must observe a Sabbath to the Lord. Now, whenever we're looking at this, one of the things to notice is that we're actually jumping in the middle of a story, okay? We're jumping in the middle of two parties that are in this trust relationship. You have God and you have the people of Israel. And the promise that we see here is this promise about this land that they are going to enter. But this assumes that we already know what this promise is. So what we're going to do is take a minute to give us a little background on this promise that God gave to his people. Because really, this is the culmination in a lot of ways of a promise that began back in Genesis chapter 12. And if you look at Genesis chapter 12, what you see happen there is God gives a promise to a guy named Abraham. In this passage, you'll see his name as Abram, but his name's later changed. So I'm just going to call him Abraham for today. And God gives Abraham a promise about what will happen if he leaves his family. Here's what it says in Genesis chapter 12, verses 1 through 3. This is part of this bigger story we're jumping in on. It says, the Lord had said to Abram, go from your country your people, and your father's household to the land I will show you. So God's going to give them a land. What's going to happen? I will make you into a great nation, and I will bless you. I will make your name great, and you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And all the peoples on earth will be blessed through you. So here we see God give a promise to this guy named Abraham, right? And what we see is that whenever we come to Leviticus chapter 25, we are on the other side of this promise. The people are in a new spot. In fact, they've just come out of slavery. They're coming from 400 years of slavery in Egypt, and they're coming to this new land that they are entering. They're coming from seeing God's judgment delivered upon the people of Egypt, and they're coming to this new land where God is going to make a way for them to possess it. They're going to actually see God's judgment upon the people of Canaan that are in front of them. This was all part of God's promise. In fact, if you look at Genesis chapter 15, you see God outline this promise a little bit more beginning in verse 13. It says, "Then the Lord said to him," talking to Abraham again, "know for certain that for 400 years your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and that they will be enslaved and mistreated there. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterward they will come out with great possessions. You, however, will go to your ancestors in peace and will be buried at a good old age. In the fourth generation, your descendants will come back here, for the sin of the Amorites has not yet reached its full measure." So again, Leviticus comes on the other side of this. After that 400 years, and apparently we've hit a point where the Amorite sin has reached its full measure. Where we see in this passage that even the land is crying out because of the wickedness of the people living there. And what God is doing is he's trying to prepare his people to understand how to live in this land he's going to give them in a way that honors the gift that he's given them. So after 400 years of slavery, we see this move taking place. And part of what God does in the book of Leviticus is he gives his people instructions on how to live differently than the Canaanites who were living in this land before them, about how to live differently from the way that they did. And you see this in a couple of passages in particular. One will be Leviticus 18, one will be Leviticus chapter 20. And what we're going to look at is what is happening with the land that they're getting ready to enter because of the way that the people there are living. So first, Leviticus chapter 18, verses 24 through 28 comes at the end of a string of commands that are really focused around sexual immorality among the people and how the people in Canaan had been living and warning the people of Israel not to live in that way. Here's what it says. It says, "Do not defile yourself in any of these ways, because this is how the nations that I'm going to drive out before you became defiled. Even the land was defiled, so I punished it for its sin, and the land vomited out its inhabitants. But you must keep my decrees and my laws. The native-born and the foreigners residing among you must not do any of these detestable things. For all these things were done by the people who lived in the land before you, and the land became defiled. And if you defile the land, it will vomit you out as it vomited out the nations that were before you." It's a pretty strong, vivid image of what's going on here. And then we read in chapter 20 where God again gives a string of commands about how to live differently than the people of Canaan. He says this, "Keep all my decrees and laws and follow them so that the land where I am bringing you to live may not vomit you out. You must not live according to the customs of the nations I'm going to drive out before you, because they did all these things I abhorred them. But I said to you, you will possess their land. I will give it to you as an inheritance, a land flowing with milk and honey. I am the Lord your God who has set you apart from the nations." So this land that God was giving to his people was vomiting out, it says, the previous occupants because of their wickedness and sin. See, their sin not only defiled them as a people, but it also defiled the land. And when we think about this, the question may be like, how was this defiling? Like, what does this even mean? What is this communicating? I think we can understand this by looking at the fact that God created all things and all things good, right? God's design is good, and God's creation has a dignity that is to be honored because God is the creator. So God's creation and the way he designed things to function, there is a dignity there that is to be honored in the way God designed things to function, that if we don't, it leads to defilement, not just for us, but for the land and things we use. There is a way in which the land that God has given us as people is something that is to be stewarded and something that is to be honored because it has dignity and value because of the creator, okay? So we are to honor and show dignity to the land. The same thing is true with our other image bearers. So if you look at a lot of the commands in Leviticus, it deals with how we interact with other people. Why? Because other people have dignity and value that is given to them because their creator is God, and we are to honor that. And whenever we don't honor the dignity of God's design or the land that God has given us or the other image bearers around us, it leads to the defilement of both people, of ourselves, in the places where we are living. The result is defilement. Jumping ahead for just a moment, God calls us as people to steward his creation. And when we fail to do so, we participate in this defilement we're talking about that often begins, again, with disregarding the dignity and value of what he has made. Now, the connection between this idea of maybe sin that people commit and or that we commit and what happens with the land, that may seem kind of foreign to us today because we just don't think about things in that way. But in the ancient world, we see that as just a normal part of life. See, even other nations that surrounded the Israelites recognized that their worship of their God was tied to the fertility or the flourishing of the land in which they lived. And we see that same sort of thing with the people of Israel. They couldn't just live however they wanted and experience the good blessing of God's design. There was a connection between the way people lived and even what happened with the land. But even beyond that, just think back to the Garden of Eden. God gave the people the land, and they had this work that they were to do there. But what happened when sin came into the world? What happened with their work? It became toil, right? Something changed whenever sin entered the picture. It even changed their relationship with this world. Now, we've talked about this before in this series, but Israel was an agrarian society, which means that they lived off of what was produced by the land or the animals that they raised on the land. And this was true for their neighbors as well, right? This is just the sort of world that they lived in. Like we talked about previously, for the people, they saw that work and worship, their relationships and all of these things were tied together. They couldn't be separated into different areas. They were aware of this connection. And so here in Leviticus chapter 25, we see that the people of Canaan were being vomited out because of their wickedness and defilement, and God's creation was crying out because of their wickedness. And so what God is doing is giving his people instructions up front about how to honor the dignity of the land they are going into. And I think that that's my last time saying vomit on purpose from stage, so you're welcome. So as they entered the land, God was giving them these instructions how to steward the land. So we see this command to provide a Sabbath for the land. And then we'll see that expanded upon in verses 3-7. Here's what God says. For 6 years, sow your fields, and for 6 years, prune your vineyards and gather their crops. But in the seventh year, the land is to have a year of Sabbath rest, a Sabbath to the Lord. Do not sow your fields or prune your vineyards. Do not reap what grows of itself or harvest grapes of your unintended vines. The land is to have a year of rest. Whatever the land yields during the Sabbath year will be food for you, for yourself, your male and female servants, and the hired workers and temporary resident who live among you, as well as for your livestock and the wild animals in your land. Whatever the land produces may be eaten. So here we see that there's this idea of a Sabbath for the land every 7 years. In creation, God gave people the command to work faithfully for 6 days and then have a Sabbath rest where they would stop, enjoy, and worship God 1 day out of every seven. So there were 6 days of faithful work, 1 day of faithful rest that they were commanded to. In this picture, we see that there are to be 6 years of faithful work and then 1 year of faithful rest in the land for them and then also for the land that God was giving them. There was a different sort of rhythm that they were being given. Now, let's think about this whole picture that God's inviting them into, again, in and through this lens of a trust fall. Who are the two parties involved here? You have God and Israel, yes, thank you. The people of Israel, right? So you have two parties. There's a promise. What is it that God promises them? He's going to provide for them, right? He's going to give them this land, and he's going to provide what they need. There's an invitation, though, that's really hard. Do not sow your fields in that seventh year, okay? There's a real risk in this, right? What happens if God doesn't come through on his promise? What happens to the people? They die. Okay, this isn't like, oh, if my garden doesn't work, I'll just go to Walmart and pick up what I don't have. Or it's not like, oh, if my field doesn't produce, then I'll go to Logan's field and Logan's field will produce. Why? Because Logan's doing the same thing I am. This is a nationwide command. So there is a real risk going on here, but then God also invites them into an act of trust, which is what? Actually observing the year of Sabbath, and he gives them the opportunity to experience an act of faithfulness, God coming through on his word. Now, if this once out of seven, every 7 years thing doesn't seem crazy enough, let's pick things up in verse 8 to see where God goes from there. God says, count off 7 Sabbath years, 7 times 7 years. Who can do 7 squared? Anybody? Hey, what's 7 times 7? 49. Okay, great. He's ready for school. We're ready. Okay, week and a half. We're there. Okay, 7 times 7, right? 49. So we see it here. 7 times 7 years. So the 7 Sabbath years amount to a period of, you were right, Abe, 49 years. Then have the trumpet sounded everywhere on the 10th day of the 7th month on the Day of Atonement. Sound the trumpet throughout the land. Consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you. Each of you is to return to your family property and to your own clan. So basically here we see God gave the people of Israel a once-in-a-lifetime gift where there would be this jubilee, a day of liberty and return. The jubilee was a day where they would return to the land that God had given them when they first entered the promised land. So as they go into the promised land, God breaks up the land among the different clans based upon their sizes. And what would happen here is once every 50 years, if they had given up that land because they hit a point of poverty or whatever it may be, that land would be restored to their family. In the same way, if they had come upon hard times and they actually hired themselves out as a worker, they would be released from that work that they had been given. And we would see here that all debts would have been expired. This year of Jubilee would have been a crazy reset back to what God had designed, where people don't get caught into spirals from generation to generation of finding themselves falling farther and farther from what God intends for them. But how would this work? Like, is this just really unjust where, like, these people would buy up a bunch of land and then they would be taken advantage of and just have to give it back? No, God actually set this up so it was a very just sort of thing. In a lot of ways, the land that they had was a possession that they were entrusted with. So if someone sold off the land, what they were selling off is not so much ownership of the land, but the rights to a certain number of harvests, okay? So if this is year 9 of the cycle, what happens is the next, I should have done a number where I can do math with, next 40 years, they would be giving up those harvest years to the person who bought the land, okay? In the same way, if someone sold themselves as a hired worker, they weren't selling like their very being. They were selling a certain number of years of service. So in year 1, the price was much more expensive because there were a lot more years in front of that than if it were in year 45, right? It was dependent upon how many harvests remained, the price that they could sell things for. And God provided a way for people not to get, again, stuck in these different patterns that may come about. And so whenever a landowner or whenever someone bought additional land or they bought the rights to farm it, they were receiving that number of harvests as they continued to move forward. There was a way in which God set this up to prevent taking advantage of others in poverty as well as creating a just society for all. Leviticus chapter 25, verse 17 talks a little bit about this danger of taking advantage of others. What can happen sometimes in a culture is people just begin to do whatever it is that will help them and their family. But God says this, he says, do not take advantage of each other, but fear your God. I am the Lord. See, I think it's striking that this day would take place, this jubilee would take place on the 10th day of the seventh month, which was the Day of Atonement. Why is that significant? Because that was a day each year where the people of Israel would have a reminder that their sin had been dealt with, right? That the debt that they owed to God had been erased. They'd experienced forgiveness. They'd experienced cleansing from the impact of sin in their life. And they had been declared both guilt-free before God and cleansed before God as well. And it's wild to think that once every 50 years, there would be a moment on that day where they would be reminded that what they had experienced with God was to impact their relationships with other people as well. In the same way that they had experienced forgiveness and grace, in the same way that God had removed their guilt and their shame, so they were to treat their brothers and sisters like that as well, and releasing them and allowing them to return to the land like God had originally broken it out. Now, such a command like this in this Sabbath year probably would have drawn some questions and some pushback, right? And so God anticipates that in chapter 25, verse 20, the second half of that verse, God anticipates this question and says, what will we eat in the seventh year if we do not plant or harvest our crops? And then God goes on to answer that in verses 21 through 22. God says, I will send such a blessing in the sixth year that the land will yield enough for 3 years. While you plant during the eighth year, you will eat from the old crop and will continue to eat from it until the harvest of the ninth year comes in. Again, let's not miss the level of faith that God is calling his people to. There is real risk here. If God doesn't come through on his promise, it's not just that they miss out on what they need to plant for year seven, but the very next year they don't have any food to eat or they don't have what they need to plant so that they can harvest in year nine. It's like there's a three-year gap here where they were trusting God to provide in a way that may not have made sense in their mind. Again, there is no, we'll just run to Walmart and figure it out. The thing I want us to see here is that God calls his people to faithful work, faithful rest, and a deep trust in his provision. I draw this out because I think we miss this sometimes. God does call us to faithful work. But it's not work that is simply asking the question, how do I benefit myself or how is it that I save up for what is to come in the future? It's faithful work, stewarding what God has put around us for his purposes and his purposes alone. So as we work, we're not just working for ourselves. We are working as an extension of God's kingdom. We are called to be faithful in that work. Not just to punch a time clock, not just to make it through a day, but to be faithful in our work to bless the world around us. But we're also called to be faithful in our rest, which is another level of trust, right? To trust that if we rest, we stop, we enjoy to worship, and we have rhythms of this, we trust that God is going to honor that. That God works in a way that our brains may not be able to wrap around, and that in that faithful rest, that God restores and renews in a way that we can't imagine. And so both of those things require deep trust in God's provision. That wasn't just something for these people 3,400 years ago. It's something for us today to recognize faithfulness in work, faithfulness in rest are both significant. Now, the logic of this command is tied up in a truth that comes out in the following verses. Verse 23 and 24, it says, the land must not be sold permanently. Why? Because the land is mine, says the Lord, and you reside in my land as foreigners and strangers. Throughout the land you hold as a possession, you must provide for the redemption of the land. You see, the truth that one must believe to take up God on his promises to do something crazy like we see here in Leviticus chapter 25 really comes up in Psalm 24, verse 1. This is the truth that we must embrace. It's this, that the earth is the Lord's and most of the things in it, and the world and most of those that live in it, right? No, the earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. Let's go back to what we said at the beginning about a trust fall. There are truths that are easy to affirm in our minds, but if it came to actually acting on it, it may be a little harder. This is one of those. The earth is the Lord's and everything in it, the world and all who live in it. You see, this is at the heart of Leviticus chapter 25. God is setting up a way of life for his people that would recognize and honor that truth. That would recognize and honor the fact that God was calling his people to shift from seeing the land and their fellow people as an object to be used for their own benefit to seeing the land and their fellow people as belonging to God and deserving of honor because of that. Now, why is that so significant? What's happened for the last 400 years of their history? What have they seen? They've seen those in power treating people as objects, to work the land to benefit the Egyptians who are in power, right? So for 400 years, they've been trained as a people to think, this is how you live in a land. You maximize whatever it is that serves those who are in power in this land. They've spent 400 years seeing other image bearers of God treated as objects to be consumed or objects to be used for the benefit of a certain group of people. And here God is calling them again to shift from seeing the land and their fellow people as objects to be used for their benefit to seeing the land and their fellow people as belonging to God. God was making clear from the beginning that his people were to possess this land, but they were to recognize that it ultimately belonged to God. Rather than owning the land, God calls his people to be faithful stewards. And what does a faithful steward do? Uses the land or whatever it is they've been entrusted with for the purposes of the owner. And so God is calling his people to faithfully steward the land and the image bearers around them for his purposes and his purposes alone. And this fights against a lot of our modern ideals. Our standard and expectation in our world is oftentimes for continual growth and maximized profit, right? How do we continually grow and maximize profit? And I'm here to tell you, continual growth and maximized profit are actually pretty good things, but they're not the end. See, it's good for you if you're in a business or you're in a place of employment to seek to both maximize the profit and continually grow as an employee or as a company. You want to see those things, but not as an end to themselves. What we have to see is that in God's economy, those things are done to the end of stewarding what it is that God has given us, to bringing honor to him in the world. So continual growth, maximize profit, not necessarily a bad thing unless it becomes the one thing that you're driving people towards and leading people to. So if you are a leader in a business, one of the things to think about in this lens is what is it that you're calling people to? Is the end goal a bottom line, or is the end goal to steward something for the benefit of the world around you? If you're a business owner, think about that in and through how you treat your employees. What type of benefits do you offer? Is it the cheapest package you can come up with, or is it something that honors the dignity and value of those that are investing? If you're working in a place and you provide direct care to someone, whether that's an employee or a client or a patient, what does it look like to be present with people and to show them honor and dignity instead of just trying to be as quick as you can to move on to the next thing because that's how more money is made. That's how you maximize profit, just moving through. No, if it's maximizing profit at the expense of treating people as image bearers of God, God says, pause. This is about serving people. In the same way, if you're thinking about offering services to people, a question that we would have to ask to be faithful here is my service actually serving people, or is it just serving my bottom line? Am I selling things? Am I providing things that are actually benefiting the world around us, giving them a taste of God's design for them, or is this just about increasing profit? We have to wrestle through these things as people of God. Because we have to see that what we've been entrusted with is not for us or about us, but it's for and about his kingdom and his kingdom being advanced. You see, in the Sabbath year and in the Jubilee, God is calling his people to practical expressions of faith. And that faith includes pursuing relationships, showing dignity and justice and mercy to those around them. Now, one of the things that's kind of interesting is we never see, like, recorded in the Old Testament an example of the people of Israel actually doing what God commanded here. Now, in a weird way, we also don't see them observing the Day of Atonement in any recorded way either. So it may have happened and we just don't know about it. But what we do know is that there was at least a period of time where they ignored it. And what happened is the people ended up being, I guess I lied, I am going to say vomit again. They ended up being vomited out of the land once again. But what happens in that really stood out to me. It comes in 2 Chronicles chapter 36, verse 21. Here's what the author of that book records. It says, the land, this is talking after the exile, when God's people are driven out of the land, it says, the land enjoyed its Sabbath rest. All the time of its desolation, it rested until 70 years were completed in fulfillment of the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah. So God made sure that his creation enjoyed his design, even if it meant that his people had to be driven out of the land because of their wickedness. Now, this is all good and interesting, especially if you're like a history nerd like I am. But what does this mean for us some 3,400 years later? What does it mean for us in a world more shaped by industry and technology and information? To get to that answer, I think we need to fast forward in the story a bit. Again, it didn't start here in Leviticus 25. We saw back in Genesis 12 some of the origins there, but we need to fast forward to see how this culminates in the life and ministry of Jesus. See, because in Luke chapter 4, when Jesus first begins his ministry, he talks about a little bit of the fulfillment of this jubilee coming in and through what it is that Jesus did. Here's what we find in Luke 4, verses 16 through 21. It says, he, talking about Jesus, went to Nazareth where he had been brought up. And on the Sabbath day, he went into the synagogue, as was his custom. He stood up to read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was handed to him. Unrolling it, he found the place where it is written, "The Spirit of the Lord is on me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight to the blind, to set the oppressed free, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." That's understood as referring to this idea of this jubilee coming. So that's part of what Jesus was proclaiming. Then he rolled up the scroll, gave it back to the attendant, sat down, and the eyes of everyone in the synagogue were fastened on him. And he began by saying to them, "Today the scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." The day of the Lord's favor, this day of Jubilee, came in and through the person and work of Jesus. And now as his people, we are invited to live in that same mission that Jesus had. To bring about liberty, to bring about return, to bring about freedom, to bring about redemption in the world around us in and through how we work and how we live in our spaces. Now, we've talked a little bit about this whole idea of this trust fall bit, right? Where there is two parties involved. And right now, I want to wrap up by thinking about this one more time. If you're thinking about you and God, and you think about in this picture, there is a promise that God gives you, which is if you take steps of trust, I'll come through. I'll show myself faithful. If you steward what it is that I've given you, you can trust me to come through on my end of the deal. And God offers us an invitation to actually take a step of trust. And if we will act upon that, we have an opportunity to experience God's faithfulness. So as we wrap things up, what I want us to do is think about the opportunity to experience God's trustworthiness. What are some ways that we might practice this week? I want us to think about a couple different categories. I want us to think about our possessions, our homes, our families, and our work. So with our possessions, have you ever noticed how the accumulation of things can sometimes lead to you actually feeling more weighed down? Like there are a lot of ways in which maybe it feels like you need these different things, but as you accumulate them, sometimes your possessions begin to feel more like they own you than you own them. What would shift if you began to see that all you possess belongs to God and is to be stewarded for Him and His purposes? What is it that you have in your life right now that you would consider maybe getting rid of? Because you realize, oh, I don't actually need that, and that actually gets in the way of me stewarding my life in a greater way for God and His purposes. What would you use differently if you saw yourself as a steward and not an owner? How might what you have be used to bring a taste of heaven to the world around you? Think about that, the category of possessions. Or maybe your home. You see, your home, regardless of how big or small it is, has been entrusted to you by God for His purposes, not just for your comfort. So what might it look like for you to invite others into that space? For your home or your apartment to be a space where people can experience freedom and joy, where people can experience a return to God's design for community and for connection and for vulnerability around a table. What might it look like for you to shift the way you view your home? Or your family. I hate to break it to you, but your family isn't about you. Rather, your family is a gift that is to be stewarded for God and His purposes. So how can you be faithful as an individual and as a family unit to offer some hope to those around you? If you're looking for steps to take as a family, we still have some summer serve bingo cards that have some ideas of how you could serve maybe as a family or as a group of friends and how you could begin to maybe see more of your life and your time and the things that God has entrusted you with, how you can maybe better use those to serve the world around you. Or think about your work. You see, you have the opportunity day in and day out, whether your work is paid or unpaid at this point, even if you're retired. The way you use your time, talents, and your energy, how can you use this not for yourself, but for the glory of God and the good of creation? Think about even this week. How can you begin taking steps to recognize and name the opportunities you have to do this day in and day out? To honor what it is that God has entrusted you? How could you maybe even just name and celebrate the ways that God's already brought you into this? This isn't just about adding things to do, but beginning to recognize the way that God is already at work and choosing to continue to be faithful both in our work and in our rest. Again, all of creation is given by God, and we are called to be stewards. And as we take steps of faith, there's one more element of a trust fall that I didn't talk about earlier that comes from a successful trust fall. And that is a dynamic that I hope Colin and I experienced a little bit. But it's actually a transformed relationship. You see, in a trust fall, that wasn't like a huge jump for Colin, I don't think. He's young enough, he would have bounced back up if I would have dropped him. But think about that in some bigger things. As we take real risks and other people show themselves to be faithful, that begins to transform the relationship because we grow in our confidence and in our trust that the other person is faithful and will come through. That's what God invites us to experience in the way that we steward things. As we take steps day in and day out to be faithful with what God has entrusted us with and the people around us, the world around us, the possessions He has given us the chance to have, as we are faithful with these, we can grow in confidence and deeper trust with God if we actually release them back to Him and say, God, I want these to be used for Your purposes alone. As we take these steps to release our grip and function as stewards, we experience greater confidence and deeper trust in God. That's what He's inviting us into. So as we wrap things up today, I'm going to give us about 90 seconds to reflect on some questions that are going to come up here on the screen. As usual, these are long and probably complicated because those are the kinds of conversation starters that I write. So I want to encourage you to take a picture of these, But take some time to reflect on these now and consider who it is you might invite into a conversation this week around these points. And as you do, take a minute to reflect on these. Notice that it doesn't assume a positive answer. Part of us growing in our trust of God may be admitting the times where we feel like we've trusted him, he's not come through. So right now is a time for you to maybe even be honest with that as you reflect on these questions coming up on the screen.